And I want to be sure to ask you about the Mission Impossible film. I have to tell you, I saw the film at a public screening.
Okay.
And simply when you just came on screen, the crowd burst into cheers. Like, people were very excited. And I think it really has been one of the, like, scene-stealing performances of the year.
Oh, wonderful. Yeah, I have seen this movie about 4 times. And every time I came on screen, it was quiet. So it's nice to know. Hello, everyone, and welcome to The Envelope. I am Kelvin Washington, alongside folks you are used to seeing at this point, Yvonne Vidiel, Mark Olson, and we are excited about this episode because Emmy season, and this is one of those things, Mark, I even want to start with you, just kind of what sticks out to you? Maybe it's just someone you think is going to win or something you're expecting, maybe a trend with the theme of the show as well. What jumps out?
Well, I'm looking at the category of supporting actress in a drama, where all the ladies from The White Lotus were nominated, and people, I think, are really thinking that Carrie Coon will probably be winning in that category. Also, just she's just kind of on such a hot streak right now with The Gilded Age as well. But I have to say, I am so excited. My indie film queen, Parker Posey, who played, of course, the matriarch of the Ratliff family on the show. And I've seen her give some award speeches before, and we would be in for a real doozy if they would pick Parker Posey. I don't know that's going to happen. But I think that category just in general is going to be like a sort of a fun category to watch through the night.
Do you think she'll thank La Razzampan? She mentions it so much as her character.
We didn't even get an answer. Just a laugh.
Kicked in.
Okay. Copy that. So I go to you now. Yvonne, what about you? So we got the whole White Lotus. He says, you mentioned just pretty much, if you're on the show, you're nominated. What about you?
I'm really curious to see how the drama category shakes out. This idea of Severance that was gone for so long is really dominating. But then you have like a breakout like The Pitt that's really strong, and it'll be interesting to see like how that shakes out. I'll be happy either way. I am curious, like, if they miss the opportunity to stage like an emergency with The Pitt people there, like, come on.
That makes sense. And plus, I like how you did that, kind of foreshadowing this episode with the two shows that you picked. Mark, I want to go to you. You had a chance to talk with Tramell Tillman, speaking of Severance.
Exactly.
By the way, before you go, I brought this up one time. We talked about this. I did something on the morning news that I anchor, and I came out with a marching band from the Palisades. We had the fires in Los Angeles in January, and we had a marching band bring us in the show, and everyone was saying that I was his character. That's all it was. I thought that's literally all my entire timeline was about. That I think it dropped just the Sunday prior to me posting that. So
you got your Halloween costume ready.
So tell me more about your chat.
Well, sure. So Tramell plays the sort of what's become a real fan favorite character on the show, Mr. Milchek, who sort of is the middle manager in the office there. And as much as this has been a huge breakout role for Tramell, that it's really fascinating the road that he's had to get here, that he didn't really start acting professionally until he was into his 30s, that he had originally studied medicine, then he had finally gone back to school, studied acting, and then kind of was outside the business for a while, and then really like has sort of like hit a stride. And it's just exciting to see kind of that happen for him. And then, of course, he has the marching band sequence this year, which became such a huge, popular thing, a sort of a viral moment. And on top of that, he also had just an absolute scene-stealing performance in Mission Impossible, The Final Reckoning. And so this has just been a huge year for him so far.
We see those moments happen, right, where someone has that role that finally, out of the blue, and then you look at it and you realize, oh, I've seen him or her in a million other movies. You just didn't notice them until they finally had that role. And so it's awesome to see when that happens for folks. I go to you, Yvonne. Tell us a bit more about Catherine Lanasa. You just mentioned The Pitt. Tell us about your conversation.
Well, it fits perfectly because Catherine Lanasa is having a moment, too, on this show. She's been a working actor for a long time, but she's really had this breakout moment on The Pitt. And, The Pitt is this medical drama, and it really took off when it launched in January. Just because of the format, it's like you just want to keep going. It covers a 15-hour shift, and it just felt revelatory. And she plays Dana, this, the charge nurse at this hospital, and you really get a sense early on that she's the one that makes this place work. Mm-hmm. And she's the one that knows everything, and she knows how to deal with all the personalities. And she really has, over this 15-hour shift, a existential moment where, she experiences violence on the job, and it sort of really rattles her, and she's sort of grappling with, this job that I've had for so long is this still where I need to be? Is it time to go? And that's how the season sort of ends with her, of her coming, like her having this reckoning of, is this over for me or am I going to keep going? And it was really just great to talk to her about, you know, having this moment at this point in her career.
And that's what we're talking about. You know, folks get their moment whenever it comes. Obviously, I'm sure it's very appreciated. All right, let's get to Tramell Tillman and Mark's conversation. Here it is.
For the Los Angeles Times, welcome to the Envelope Podcast. I'm Mark Olson, and I'm here today with Tramell Tillman from the show Severance that plays the audience favorite character, Mr. Milchick. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
And now before we start talking about Severance, I want to go back a little bit to talk a little some about, and please correct me if I'm wrong, as I understand it, you didn't really start acting professionally until you were in your 30s, and that there had been some, you know, a few other things. You'd been in school and working. And I'm always so curious about that when people, you know, aren't kind of a prodigy, aren't a success right out of the gate. For you, like, what was that road like? Like, what was it like for you sort of getting to be able to say, I'm going to be an actor?
It's more like a cul-de-sac. You know, it was kind of going in and out, right? And going in circles a bit. It was not a straight journey for me at all. You know, I made the commitment that I wanted to be an actor when I was 10 and was really shy about pursuing it because I didn't have a lot of mentors around that were doing the work that I wanted to do at that level, right? So, you know, I leaned on the academic side and more so in the sciences. Mm-hmm. And I was studying medicine, and I told myself I was going to become an orthopedic surgeon and was going down that route, you know? But performing was always a part of my life. You know, I would perform for my family, especially the adults in the house when they were bored and didn't want to watch TV. They put all the cousins, the babies, and the grandkids up in front of them. We had to do little talent shows, right? And my first performance in front of a live audience of strangers, if you will, was at the church, you know, when I was 10. But there was something that clicked, and I wanted to follow that spark. And it never went away.
Hmm.
Even when I was studying medicine or selling knives door to door in Maryland or teaching about abstinence in Mississippi or, you know, rallying and pushing kids about the importance of education here and there, you know.
So for you, there always was you had the goal of becoming an actor. You, like, in your mind, you were like on your path?
I didn't commit to the path until I felt like life had just beat me down. And only in the sense that I was miserable doing everything else, you know? And I had to tap back into myself. And I was fortunate to have a wonderful mentor, Dr. Mark G. Henderson, who basically inspired me to do a lot of soul searching and figure out what was that thing that lit my fire and was performing. And it was he that inspired me to go to grad school to get the tools. He saw that I had the talent, but I needed to learn the craft. And I'm grateful I made that decision.
And then was there a movie or a performance, a play, some other actor that you saw that felt like a possibility model for you that felt like, oh, I want to do that. I could do that too.
So many actors. You know, Denzel Washington, Morgan Freeman, Angela Bassett, Lawrence Fishburne, Meryl Streep. Gene Hackman, you know, I was watching so many films as a kid. I loved what they were doing. I loved the stories that they were telling. And so they were all examples of what could be. I just didn't know how they went about their journey. And then if you look at all of their stories, it's very different. Yeah. So there's no one way to get to where you want to be, specifically in this industry. But you just got to keep trying.
And but then even after you went to graduate school, I think there was a few years after school before you really sort of got your career going.
Yeah.
What were those years like for you?
They were tough. So after graduate school, I had four jobs. I was living in New York and I was determined not to be a starving artist. So I had two jobs working at a nonprofit. I had a job working in catering. And then, of course, I had my acting gig. And so that kept me incredibly busy. But it's a grind. Acting itself, the business of it is a grind. And then New York City is a hustle right? Yeah. So you're always going, you're always moving and learning, and you got to move quick and learn quicker.
Mm.
But it really prepared me for severance in a way. You know, I'd had all these corporate jobs, which who'd have thought come in handy?
Right.
You know, these are just survival gigs. But it all fueled me to where I am now.
With Severance, the first season was well received, but this second season has just seemed like a phenomenon. It just seems like the show has really skyrocketed. To you, what do you think it is that audiences are really responding to?
Definitely the mystery. We want to know what is going on at Lumen, you know. But it's also, there's a human story there. We give so much of ourselves at work, and a lot of times we are not who we are at work versus home.
Mm.
And so this show really speaks to that. It speaks to the human condition, the investments that we have within ourselves and the relationships. And it begs the question, why are we doing this and who is it for?
Are those the same things that you responded to when you, you know, first read the script, when you first sort of were approached about the project?
I was very curious about what this show was, right? So I got the sides, and my audition sides were the red ball scene.
Mm-hmm.
And the scene with Milchick and, we learn later, Helena in the stairwell, where he's encouraging her that she's doing the right thing, go back into the wall and finish her work. So I didn't really have a concept of what this thing was. I just knew that this guy was a motivator. He was a leader. He was a teacher. He was someone that you can trust, but he was also someone that you didn't want to mess with.
Mm-hmm.
So I just really leaned into trying to find who this guy was and make him a whole human, you know? And I really had fun with the process.
There are so many just wild fan theories around the show. And do you find, first of all, I don't know how much you even engage with all that or are aware of it, but do you find that, does it inform your own understanding of the show at all?
I had to kind of avoid it. You know, first of all, it's very addictive.
Yeah.
You know, you're reading the comments, you know, you're reading the Reddit threads, and the contributions, the thoughts behind it are so intoxicating, and they're really well thought out, you know? And it makes me think as an actor, it's like, but is that what we were doing? Is that the story we're telling? You know, and then I'll call Dan or Ben. It's like, wait, but someone said this, and this is kind of a little spot on. Mm-hmm. And they're like, no, that's not what's happening at all. You know, but it's just this whole journey. And I think it's a testament to how great the show is. It also speaks to the intelligence of our fans and the passion behind the show. Mm-hmm. It's enriching. It's empowering as well.
How do you play to the enigma? Like, how do you sort of grapple with all the unknown factors to this world, to your character? Are you having to answer all those questions for yourself, like before you perform a scene, or can you somehow like embrace the mystery and know that there are going to be unknowns?
Well, with this character, he's really special because this is one of the rare instances where the character knows more than the actor.
Mm.
And so that gets really tricky as well. And so there are things that you're just not going to know, and you have to let go to that. There are constant conversations that I have with Dan and Ben and with the fellow directors of trying to figure out what this world is. And so because the world itself is an enigma, you don't have to play the enigma. You just lean into the circumstances that have been set up and trust that it will reveal itself in the process.
I've never even thought about that before. Like, is it the idea that the character knows more than the actor playing the character? Does that make you feel wrong-footed? Or like at any point, do you learn something about the character down the line and maybe wish you'd played an earlier scene a little different?
All the time. All the time. But, you know, that's where the trust comes in, right? You know, you're trusting that you have a team of people that will lead you in the right direction, that there are people that have vision, you know, that you have great writers and cinematographers and directors that really understand the journey.
Hmm.
And while I might not get it, I can lean on them to help me get there. And they're very vocal. If I'm off, they'll tell me.
Hmm. Because it's, I think, especially in this second season, it's been so exciting in that, you know, your character of Milchick is very much a company man, but it also, there seems to be a growing sense of conflict inside of him.
Sure.
And so for you, like, how do you interpret that? Like, for you, what's going on with him?
you know, we started in chaos from season one, day one, right? And season two really ups the ante because now he's in a position of leadership and no one is helping him navigate this new space. And he's being thrusted in all these different situations and circumstances, and the innies are not helping him by any means. They're making his job a lot harder. And, you know, he's learning the lessons of what it is to move up, you know, in corporate America, that it's not so much easier just because you have this leadership title. And I think that's what the audience is experiencing. We're starting to see the cracks beneath the veneer.
Because are you approaching him in a sense as like a prison guard who's suddenly becoming too sympathetic to his charges?
I wouldn't say a prison guard who's too sympathetic. You know, I've approached him as a man who is committed to the job. He's a person of duty by any means necessary. And we see the differences in how Cobell leads, which is very much old school, versus Milchick, which is, let's do kindness reforms. Let's give them what they want. Let's kind of help them along, and maybe that will bring about positive results. But we see it doesn't.
Because I think audiences have been really surprised by how empathetic they are feeling towards Milchick. I don't think people expect that. And one way to put that as a question is simply, like, do you see him as one of the villains of the story?
You know, my tendency was to think he was a villain in season one. But as I stepped further into the script, I think there's something more interesting about this story. And to categorize him as a villain, I think it's a bit short-sighted. It's easy to go that route. And so what I really enjoy is the conversation where people are discussing if he is a villain, because I think there is more to mine. There's more to understand.
How have you been exploring that for yourself? Like as you get a script for each episode, how are you sort of continuing to like evolve your own understanding of who Milchick is?
I really just allow the page to inform me. You know, try not to have any preconceived notions of where you think it's going to go, and just lean into the circumstances. And, you know, Dan Erickson and his writing team does such a great job in presenting a wonderful roadmap to get you from point A to point B and then C and then D. And if you don't anticipate, it's really quite a fascinating journey.
How have your own experiences with office culture sort of informed your performance as the character and just your sort of understanding of this world?
Okay, so one of the jobs I had, I was an assistant to the vice president of accounting and controls for a finance company, right? A world I knew nothing about. But essentially my job was to file financial reports, do travel and scheduling and so forth and so on. But on top of that, I was in charge of office culture. So I had to come up with these innovative ideas to keep positive morale in the office. Sound familiar?
Yes.
That was a wonderful exercise that I helped, you know, that really helped me fuel building and constructing Milchick. You know, I spent years as a cater waiter. You know, so being able to have a sense of customer service was really important. I used to sell. I was in retail. So being able to anticipate a need, being able to offer a product or an idea like we see in season two where Milchick visits Mark's Audi, he gives him all of these incentives. Being able to construct that in such a way that is pleasant and not threatening was really important. So this guy, he's having to go from being an administrator to the innies to being almost a customer service rep to the Audis. And that was really intriguing to me.
Because this season we've seen Milchick suffer a lot of micro and some not so micro aggressions, many of them based around race. And was that something that was familiar to you from your own time in office culture?
I think it was just familiar to me, just period. Just living and being in various circumstances, living in the South, being in, you know, the Midwest at times, you know, just kind of a symptom of existing, unfortunately.
And because I've seen you describe yourself as a reformed people pleaser.
Yes.
And would you say that Milchick is on that same trajectory?
Oh, he's 100% a people pleaser. I don't know. He's definitely not reformed. He's definitely not. You know, when we see him at the end of the second season, you know, we don't know what to think.
Mm-hmm.
We don't know where he's going to go next. And that's exciting to me.
But what made you change that in yourself?
It's exhausting. It's 100% exhausting. And it's impossible. You know, someone's always going to be upset about something or find fault in anything. So, you know, once I started following my bliss and going after the things that I wanted to do, there was a sense of freedom there. It was a liberation. And at a certain point, you just realize that, you know what? I don't have to prove myself to people. I can just be. I can just exist.
And now there's one line in particular in this past season, devour feculence.
Yes.
Which turns into a real turning point for the character. He sort of is standing up to one of his superiors who had reprimanded him for the language that he uses. Can you tell me a little bit about what that moment sort of meant to you and for the character?
I felt it was a defining moment. We don't see him talking back to administration at any point, even in season one. He's always been respectful, always played by the rules. And so, again, just like I talked about the roadmap earlier, what the writers have done is create a series of circumstances where it would make sense for him to respond in such a way that could jeopardize his job, you know? And if you really think about it, this man has gone through a lot in a short period of time. So there really is no way for him to process any of this information. This company has been turned upside down seemingly overnight.
Mm.
And he's had to bear it all. And even though he's keeping things on the track as best as he can, he still doesn't get the respect that he deserves.
Mm.
So yeah, he would tell him, devour feculence. It's like, get off my back, dude. I'm doing what I can, you know?
But when you see that moment in the script, in particular, that just very distinctive two-word phrase, your delivery of it is so fantastic because you don't oversell the line. Like, can you tell me, like, how do you kind of, like, for yourself, like, decide on just how to deliver that phrase? Because it could obviously go in many different directions.
Sure. So first I had to look up the word. I was like, what is it? Wait, what? I didn't know what this was. And I said, okay, this is what we're doing. He's telling him what to do. And this felt like such an empowering moment for him because this is the one moment we see him stand up for himself. And I said, okay, you got to sell this, but you have to sell it in only the way that Milchick would sell it. And this man is very measured. He doesn't need to raise his voice a lot to get a point across. I believe he knows his power. He's able to manipulate people very easily and very quickly. So for him to deliver that line in that monotone and that simple delivery speaks to his power and the knowledge that he has of himself. And also it makes it so much more effective. Because if you yell it at somebody, you know, they'll kind of overlook it. They don't hear it as well. But to just like whisper it, it lands.
And then I have to ask you about the drumline sequence this season. Now it takes the kind of the music dance experience from season one to like a whole new place. And I'm just so curious about the origins of that performance. And when was it first sort of just, you know, presented to you? Oh, and by the way, we want you to lead a marching band drumline through the office.
So I believe we were in the middle of filming season two, and I was approached about this marching band idea. And I was reticent about it because I did not want to replicate what we did in the music dance experience, because that's iconic of itself. But we continued having conversation with the creative team and try to explore ways of making sense of the moment so it didn't feel like just a one-off, like, oh, this man just has a band and, like, you know, whatever. So we tried to find purpose behind it. And so knowing that this man was at a point, a breaking point, with Lumen and at this mysterious moment of where his moves were, I felt that it was really important to infuse his own identity in this, right? Mm-hmm. Because in the second season, we start to see that race becomes a thing in the world of Lumen. So it's how can we dovetail the microaggressions that you had mentioned before, his journey, his role in leadership, and also the showmanship this man has. Mm-hmm. You know, if he's going to do anything, it's going to be big. It's going to be massive. And it was a wonderful marriage.
And now you've already at the Paley Festival, TV yeah. Festival, you did a live performance with a band, and you're going to be doing another one coming up soon. How are you finding that? Like, how are you preparing for these live performances with, you know, leading a marching band?
It's a dream. You know, coming from a historically black college and university, I would see the marching bands and I was in awe. You know, I was in marching band when I was in high school. I played the alto saxophone, you know, and to be able to serve as band leader and drum leader or drum major for a group of incredible musicians is an absolute dream.
Mm. But now, is there a part of you that's kind of like, what exactly did I sign up for here? Are you concerned that you're going to be asked to lead marching bands for the rest of your career?
You know, when I signed up to join the cast of Severance, and we had to pause for the pandemic, and I was reading through the rest of the script, it was at that point I realized, oh, this is something different. I signed up for something that is insane. And every addition ever since in season two, I said, yep, that's insane. That's insane. This is insane. But you know what? It makes sense.
But now, are you enjoying that surprise aspect of it? That like every time you get a script, you kind of genuinely have no idea what could be coming next.
I am leaning into that now more and more. Just allowing life to take its course.
There was a big time gap just between mm-hmm. season one and season two. And I know there's been a lot of talk that there's not going to be the same kind of, not going to take as long to make season three. But how is that for you schedule-wise? Like, are you able to sort of like take on other projects, do other things? Like, in a way, I'm asking, are you able to sort of like take advantage of this moment that you're having, this the great like attention and success that it seems the show has brought you?
Oh, absolutely. You know, so I filmed Mission Impossible right after I had wrapped my portion of season two.
Mm.
I filmed a project with Mahershala Ali, Your Mother, Your Mother, Your Mother. I just wrapped a project with Lena Dunham and Natalie Portman. So I've been staying busy, you know, and staying active. And that's me, mm-hmm. you know, being going from a shy kid to being a hustler and grinder and living in New York and just continuing the pace and doing more and more.
And tell me about the Lena Dunham project, her new film, Good Sex.
Good Sex, yes.
What was that like?
Oh, it was fantastic. It's a wonderful crew. Cast is beautiful. It's a really lovely rom-com. And Natalie is a queen.
Mm.
Absolutely. And Lena is such a delight. She has a passion for this. She is so supportive. And I can't wait to see it.
And then you also mentioned Basim Tariq's Your Mother, Your Mother, Your Mother, which has you, Mahershala Ali is on the cast, Giancarlo Esposito is in the cast.
Yes.
And I can only hope that the three of you have scenes together. Like, I would love to see the three of you on screen together.
Yeah, I would like that too.
And I want to be sure to ask you about the Mission Impossible film, Mission Impossible, The Final Reckoning.
Yes.
I have to tell you, I saw the film at a public screening.
Okay.
And simply when you just came on screen, the crowd burst into cheers. Like, people were very excited. And I think it really has been one of the like scene stealing performances of the year.
Oh, wonderful. I have seen this show or seen this movie about four times. And every time I came on screen, it was quiet. So it's nice to know that people were excited to see me in this movie.
And now you have this one line, the word Mr., that you say throughout your screen time, and you just deliver it with such like verve and gusto. It's really exciting. And again, like I don't even know if that line was specifically in the script that you were referring to him like that.
It was.
But how do you kind of come to decide like just how much sort of spin to put on the ball there?
how do I come to decide? I don't know. You just feel it in the moment, you know? And again, like when you're in a position of power, I feel that these roles like Bledsoe, Captain Bledsoe and Seth Milchick, they know that they're in a position of power. And when you know it, you don't have to do too much. It's just, you command the room, you own it.
Mm. The world of that submarine that you're a part of, like yourself, Katie O'Brien, some of the other actors there, there's just like a really specific and exciting energy among the people on that submarine. How did that come to be? Like, were you having conversations among the cast or with the director, Christopher McQuarrie, as far as like what the world of that submarine was going to seem like?
Yeah, I mean, the conversations were very much present, but a lot of it was really in the moment. Like, we just dove in. And what all of those actors did beautifully was, you know, created these characters that were real.
Mm.
You know, they weren't playing at being in a submarine or playing being in military forces. They were just themselves and just allowed things to just blossom as it is.
And was it exciting for you to be a part of a movie at that scale?
Absolutely. I remember watching Mission Impossible. As a kid, you know, I never thought I'd be in it, you know, and then working alongside Tom Cruise, I mean, that's a big deal. That's kind of huge.
Like you, more than almost any other character in this movie in particular, you're like kind of putting him in his place. And there's something that's really, I think that's part of the reason why audiences got such a kick out of your character is you're like sort of like dressing him down in a way that people aren't used to seeing.
Yeah, I don't know how that happened. No, it was a lot of fun. It was so much fun. And Tom and Chris were so game and really allowed me the space to fly and have fun with it, you know. It was a delight.
Moving forward to season three of Severance, mm-hmm. Have you seen any scripts yet? Like, do you know anything that's going to be happening?
I haven't seen anything. I don't know anything. I know nothing.
But let me ask you, I've heard you describe, one of the ways you've described Milchick is as an iceberg, meaning that there's a lot that we haven't seen yet.
Yeah.
Are there specific things about him that you would like to see revealed?
I am interested in knowing how the man grew up, his background. I'm always interested in history, how people, their origin story, right?
Yeah.
And I think he has a very compelling story. As an actor, you know, I built my own idea of what the origin story is, because that for me helps fuel the character or fuel my performance into the character.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, we'll see.
For you as a performer, have you already conceived of some of what that backstory is? Like for you, do you have an idea of what you think his previous life was like?
Yeah, I do.
Anything you care to share?
I it's probably invalid because it's all wrong. That's another thing I've learned about working on this show. Everything you think is going to happen. Nope.
And how do you grapple with that? Like, especially for you as a performer, like you have ideas about the character, like where he's from, maybe where he's heading. And then the script takes him in a totally different direction. What do you do with that?
There was a point it would make me break out in hives because it felt like I had no control over it. Right. But then you realize how that bleeds into the state of the character. Right? This man, Milchick, who thinks he has control, every day is shown that he has very little control, you know? So being in that environment, while it's not fun, to a certain extent, for someone who likes to have all of the answers, it really does fuel the performance in a whole nother way.
Hmm. And now for you, with the attention, the acclaim that the role has brought you, your Emmy nomination, is this the acting life that you envisioned for yourself? Like those times when you wanted to be an actor and you were trying to get your career going, is this what you were dreaming of for yourself?
Did I dream that I would be on a show with Adam Scott, Patricia Arquette, John Turturro? It wasn't that specific, no. But I did have dreams of performing and being proud of the work that I did.
Hmm.
I did have dreams of being in movies and television. And the vision was not clear, but the desire was there.
You've been moving forward and gaining some success. Has the dream changed at all? Like what are your sort of goals now?
I definitely want to continue telling stories and narratives that I believe in, stories we haven't heard before or in perspectives that we're not familiar with. I want to continue working with, you know, quality actors and expanding in a whole different way. And it's not just, you know, in front of the camera. You know, I'm also interested in producing and directing as well.
Do you have any specific projects you want to make?
I'm really interested in African folktales. I really want to retell those stories.
Mm.
And I think there's an avenue for it.
Well, I certainly can't wait to see what comes up next. And thank you so much for joining us today.
Well, thank you for having me.
After the break, we'll have Yvonne's interview with Catherine Lanasa from The Pit.
Catherine, thanks so much for being here.
Thank you for having me.
I don't want to alarm you, but before this interview's over, we're going to have a patient roll through. And we're not going to tell you what's wrong. You're going to have to figure it out.
Patience. Better pray. Better have a God that it prays to, because I don't know anything about medicine. Literally, even the fake stuff grosses me out so much.
Really? You don't have the stomach for it?
Yeah, there's you'll see. There's some stuff in 204. I was about to say it, that I actually told the producer, I think I need some jewelry for that.
What?
Like a push gift? Like, I need a gift for dealing with it. It's so disgusting. It's so disgusting that I had to read it. I had to process that it was going to happen. And when I was happen, I had to kind of detach from my body and get through it. Yep. And then I told Mike, I said, I think I need some jewelry for that, Mike, because it was as disgusting as I thought it was going to be.
Okay. So hour four of season two, we're going to know what you're talking about.
Oh, no, you'll know. And I think it's in two. It's in 202. Yep.
What part of the body? Can you share that?
No. It's gross, though. It is gross.
Oh, my God.
It was a lot in two. It was a lot I had to deal with in two. I was like, wow, okay, guys.
Oh, my gosh. I can't wait.
Yeah, well, yeah, yeah.
Congratulations.
Thank you.
Emmy nominee. You guys were in production on season two when the news hit.
Yes.
Put me in that moment.
Well, my husband and daughter came, and then I knew they were...
Your husband's Grant Show.
Grant Show, yeah. The sexiest man alive. So they were in my dressing room, and I knew it was 12:27, and I see one AD walking behind another AD, and the man AD says to the lady AD, should we give him a break? And she says, no, let's just do this rehearsal. And I was like, snap. And then at that moment, Noah ran up, and he says, I need a bathroom break. And they gave us a break, and I ran up to my room, and they announced everybody. And somebody that they announced in some supporting category that wasn't mine, it was like an S or something. And my husband was like, oh, no, it's in alphabetical order. Oh, no. And he got so upset. I go, honey, it's not my category. But then
calm
they didn't
down,
announce
Grant.
It. Yeah. They didn't announce it on live. And so he couldn't get it up in time. I said, I have to go back to work. So I went back to work, and Miriam, who does my makeup, and I was waiting outside a set, and I was just waiting outside the trauma room, and she came, and she's like, and I looked at her, and we went in between, like, there's a little hallway, and I posted those pictures of us, yeah. And we were like, and she got nominated too. We were just like, ah, ah. And then I went out. My husband was there. And then Scott Gemmel came up, who writes it, mm-hmm. and my daughter and the head writers, Simran Baidwan. And it was just a really neat moment. It was a really neat moment. And then when we went in and they announced, and Noah came walking. I hadn't seen him. Mm-hmm. And that was just his response, that hug. It was so real.
We're very thankful you put that on Instagram so we could live in that moment. But what do you shoot after something like that? It has to be a happy moment, but on The Pit, like you said, it's either gross or sad. What do you do?
I don't even know. I think we had a moment. We kind of hung around for a while. I think they had to take Noah to do press.
Mm-hmm.
So we had some time to kind of decompress with the excitement and stuff. It was with you?
Was with
yeah,
me.
Yeah, okay.
Well, I was one of them, so
it
we gave you a
fine.
Little break.
We actually shoot short. We tend to we don't go over. So we had time. We had space.
Have you fully processed it? Is there processing of something like that?
You know, I'm really trying to... I'm going to start crying. I'm trying to just live in the power of it, you know, and live in the blessing of it. And, you know, because, you know, I didn't know this was going to happen. And it doesn't matter how good of an actress I might have been. If you don't get the opportunity, you know, if John Wells didn't give me that shot, it wouldn't have happened. And so I'm so blessed by it. And, you know, people are like, friends are having dinners for, a friend is having a dinner for me. And it really was hard for me to say, like, will you come to this dinner for me? Even doesn't matter that, you know, these wonderful people that I've worked with have written me and they're so excited, but it's really hard to say, like, will you come celebrate me? It's hard to believe that it's me. Mm-hmm. I've loved my career. I think I've always at heart been a character actress, and I've always been a supporting actress. And I think I know how to push on the story and push on the lead actor and make them look great. And I think I shine in that too, but it's just, I'm not used to being in the spotlight.
Well, there's something too with, you've been part of medical dramas before.
Have I? The Night Shift? What else was I on? The Night Shift,
but that's what I mean, in different ways.
Oh, yeah, yeah,
you were on ER as
on ER.
The mother of a patient,
yes,
who has a little dalliance with,
I know,
with one of the doctors. And then you were on Grey's Anatomy,
yes,
early in its,
yes,
season.
Yes.
So what is it like, what do you remember about those moments, just being like a small part of the thing and now to be at the center of the thing?
You know, there isn't a day that goes by that I don't remember all the years of struggle and all the auditions. And I think, like, the hallowed, you know, corridors of Warner Brothers, where we are now, and the stages, and they've always just held a magic for me.
Mm-hmm.
And I just was thinking this morning, like, here I am, like, I'm a series regular in a hit show at Warner Brothers. It doesn't pass me by. It doesn't matter how many shows I do. It's always so hard to get that next job. It's hard to get a, you know, then to be on one that's a hit, that really sings, that you love. I'm so lucky.
Mm-hmm.
I have a funny story about the ER. So my
dad.
So my dad's a surgeon.
Yes.
And he hates every medical drama that's ever been made except The Pit.
Okay.
And I was telling this to John Wells, and John said, "Yeah, I mean, we don't have." We were at a cast lunch with John Wells, and he said, I tell him this in front of everybody, and he says, "Yeah, we don't have people like make it out in broom closets." And I said, "John, I made out in the broom closet with Gorin in ER."
Didn't more than make out.
And he goes, yeah. "Well, it was like seventh season or something like that. Like, we jumped the shark already." I was like, "Okay." It was a very funny moment. What I remember about Grey's was, it was so funny. So I was that girl forever that people would say, "Oh, can you play like a witch doctor on Monday?" Or like, "Can you have this weird disease?" I had a Munchausen, not Munchausen, yeah, by proxy. That was offered to me on a Friday to do on Monday, to become a person with Munchausen. I was always that girl. Uh-huh. Lanessa will do it. She'll try anything, like Mikey with the cereal. And then I was a vegetarian for about 35 years. And during that period, I find myself on that show. And without any warning, they put a huge raw piece of steak on top of me that I guess is what they used to cauterize and look real in the, mm-hmm, TV operations. We don't use steak
on the pit. Yeah,
no,
yeah,
steaks are killed. So that's the main thing. Night Shift, I was actually pregnant. So, yeah, I remember having fun on that.
What do you remember about the audition for The Pit? Because Noah wrote a note to people auditioning, right?
Tell, yeah, Noah wrote a note, and a lot of people talk about it, but for some reason I think I'm more special in my interpretation of it. I don't know why. I feel like, no, it might have related to you, but it really related to me.
Uh-huh.
No, he wrote a note, and he talked about top-to-toe immersion, like that, and I had this feeling in the first episode, they write about how it is outside and what he comes through, and then when he goes into the ER, mm-hmm, that it's just like this whole vibe all of a sudden. And I, ever since I did Judging Amy, it sounds like a very weird thing, but I was left alone. I was a DA on Judging Amy, and I left alone at that desk for hours on end in Judging Amy. And I figured out during that show, like, how to create my own life and to have like an inner life and to have my business going all the time. And I thought, well, I'll use all this time just to, what would I do now? And then what would I do? And then what does a lawyer do? And then, you know, and figuring all that out. So it's become a part of my craft that I find very grounding, and I always like to be fully alive in my body in the imaginary life of the character at all times. So when he wrote that, I was like, that's what I'm into. So it's what I'm into, you know? Mm-hmm. And so I got it. And I had this funny feeling. He also said, leave your ego and bring your creativity.
Mm-hmm.
And for some reason that just spoke to me, that I could be as offbeat as I am. You know, that I didn't have to be, oh, now you're the strict boss, or now you're this, or now you're the pretty lady, or, mm-hmm, you know, something that was all constricted. And I had this little feeling in the back of my head, even though I hadn't gotten a good job in a couple of years. I thought, I think if I can get in front of them, I think they would want me. I think they'd be happy with me. I think I'm the kind of actor they want in that job. Mm-hmm. And I didn't really seem like the prototype for it, but then lo and behold, the tape made it up there. And then we had a Zoom. I had a Zoom with John Wells, and there was no like Zoom room. And I was out in LA and not prepared for an audition, didn't have any Dana clothes, had to like rush to Target and get a sweatsuit, you know, and then the Zoom camera, when they came on, it was all upside down, and I had to like get it and make it right side up, and it was just all kind of wonky, but it worked. So yeah, and then they sent me another a scene when I tell them I'm gonna quit, which was a different scene that ended up in the show, but it was a dramatic scene, and I sent that to them, and then I found out.
Did you have the accent all along?
No, so I had done something vaguely East Coast for my first tape, and they told me to take it down a little bit for the second take, and then for the second audition. So I took it down a little bit, and I asked him, was it okay? He's like, don't worry about it now. And I was like, okay, so I just let it go. And but I knew that if I didn't learn a Pittsburgh accent, I would sound vaguely East Coast or like I was from New Jersey in the show. And being from Louisiana and being a Southerner and having people get that wrong so much, I didn't want to offend the people of Pittsburgh. And I thought, you know, I would try it. And it went actually quite terribly. And it was really bad. And I cried a lot. And I told my acting coach, like, why am I doing this? Like, why can't I just be like a normal actor and not have to always just be some extra? And she said, is there any way in hell you would play this character on stage and not do this accent? And I said, no. She said, keep going.
Wow.
And then I watched, I was watching Mayor of Easttown so much that it was on in my bathtub. And then it rolled out and the extras came on and they started talking about the accent and the dialect coach came on. And I contacted her on IMDb Pro. I figured out how to find her and she hooked me up with Suzanne Sulby, who put my accent into shape in time to do the show.
So you're ready for your trip to Wawa.
Yeah.
At any point.
Yeah.
Not even 3 minutes into hour one, we really get a sense of Dana and how crucial she is to this ecosystem. It's not only like how crucial she is to the place of where she works, but how crucial she is to us as audience viewers. And it's through her that we learn that Collins is pregnant. It's through her that we realize why Robbie is going to have a rough day today. What did that unlock for you about like who she is and how she moves through this space and interacts with her coworkers?
I just want to say, I think I was just at a place in my life where I'd been through a lot. So I think I had a great understanding of the human condition just as a person. And I think that I'm the kind of person, for whatever reason, strangers, any people tell me a lot of stuff. So I think I have some of that. I think John Wells is good at casting and Kathy Sandrich is good at casting people kind of a little bit close to who they are. And then I also think that I'm a very take charge person. Some people that are married to me might think I'm bossy. But yeah, so I think I had a lot of the qualities of Dana. But I think playing the role and dealing with people that are in such traumatic situations and having to focus on that, like in my imagination, like believe that this is what's going on with them, it really did soften me up as a person, because it just really makes you think. It's a lesson every day in you don't know what people are going through. You don't know what people are going through and how much a soft hand and it matters, how much empathy and compassion matters.
Well, I want to dig into that a little bit more. You wrote a really lovely and touching essay for Women's Health Magazine about, you know, how this role was sort of a love letter to the nurses who cared for you during your breast cancer treatment. Talk to me a little bit about how that formed or shaped what you brought to Dana, and what do you remember about that time in terms of the little things, the little details that really do, like, make a day or break a day for a patient?
Yeah, I was pretty stoic during the process, But I have to say that at Piedmont in Atlanta, the nursing staff was incredibly kind. It was not like I'd experienced maybe in other places where I'd had babies. But it was just really kind. I was just like, I don't know if everyone's just nice to you because you have cancer. I don't know what's going on, but these people are really nice. And it really mattered. I think the warm blankets really mattered a lot. It's just so thoughtful. You know, when you have to kind of constantly be going in an MRI or these different machines, the radiation machines, are it's a head trip. You know, it's a head trip to go get radiated every day. And when someone is caring and offers you a warm blanket or offers you something like that, it really matters. And after my cancer treatment, I went through a rough period of a few months where we weren't sure if there was some other things wrong with me, and I had to keep going back to the ER. And that was the part that kind of broke me, because I had been very healthy, and then now I never stopped going to the hospital, and do I have this, and do I have that, and do I have this? And there was like a lot of scans and a lot of stuff, and I broke down in the ER. It was the second time I'd gone back to the ER, and in the triage. And the triage nurse just took me aside, and she just like basically wrapped me in her arms and was like, the first 6 months out of after cancer are really bumpy. It's not going to stay like this. Do you need an Ativan? And I was like, no. And my husband's like, are you sure? But just the way that she was, you know, and she said that her, I think it was her sister-in-law had, was just going through the same thing. And just taking that time, it was so human. And there's just something about nurses that where they're good nurses are so capable, and yet they're so human. They're not coming down from the ivory tower like the doctors. They're right there with you. They're in it with you. It really mattered. And so, I mean, yeah, that's what I wanted to show. But I hope that in a way I'm like, I hope that, you know, I'm, I think that tired old working women everywhere relate to Dana, you know? You don't have to be a nurse. It's like, oh, that's me. I know her. That's me. Or that's my mom. Or that's my aunt. You know, everybody tells me, like, my mom or my aunt, you're their favorite character. It's always some tired old lady. And I'm like, I get it. I see you, tired old working women.
But still showing compassion, because there is that moment where she covers the feet.
Like, yes, that was so sweet. They wrote that after I told them about the blankets. Yeah, they wrote that.
See, it matters.
It does matter. I'll do anything for a warm blanket. If you ever have bad news, just bring me a warm blanket.
Exactly. The character is also loosely based on Kathy Garvin, who's a nurse at LA General. What do you remember about shadowing her? Like, what impressed you about what this job entails? What did you want to know? What did it illuminate for you?
I think the two most impressive things were, one, that she told me that she wouldn't do this job if it wasn't at a public hospital, if it wasn't a county, that she wanted to work for people who needed her. So, and they kind of put that into the story. And so that was really impressive. And also they had a guy there that was one of their regulars, like we have our regulars. And she knew him, and it was kind of like, I couldn't see him, but I could see his feet, and there were like some guards there because he was like having a psychotic episode of some sort, and they have to kind of, they have to just kind of be on guard, I guess. The security was there, but no one was touching him or anything. And she was like, he's probably going to die soon. He's lost this many pounds, you know, and he really comes for attention. And all the things that she knew about him, it was just so matter of fact, but there was a lot of compassion in it as well. And then the other thing was about the sandwiches. So they cut my line with Earl. I had a whole bit with Earl in episode one about sandwiches, and they ended up cutting it. Earl of Sandwich. So inside joke. So I wanted to know, what's the deal with the sandwiches? And she said, you know, technically we're supposed to write down if we give patients food. She says, but if they're hungry, you know, I just give them a sandwich. I don't, and I wanted to see where the sandwiches were and everything, and what they, the whole thing. And so she had also talked, and I also asked her if people are jerks, like I have insurance, if they're the Doug Driscolls, do you kind of, do you give them less preferable treatment? And she said no, because it's so serious. Whatever people are going through, if they're here, it's serious. But I might not give them a sandwich. And so I understood like the power of food.
It applies in life too, right?
It does. Outside, I know, exactly.
Not giving the sandwich. Ma'am. No sandwich for you.
Ma'am. ma'am.
Well, let's talk about Doug Driscoll in episode 9. It's a big turning point for Dana. She's attacked by Doug at the end, and it's a shocking moment that's been building. And this episode was written by Noah, right?
Yes.
What do you remember about shooting that moment?
So that was such a fun episode for me. Like, that was the first episode where I really got to do a lot and sort of showcase Dana. And I think he wanted just to showcase what a nurse in the ER might do and what it might look like to somebody that doesn't know what she's doing, you know. And you sort of see both their, you know, his frustration building and her exhaustion building in a way that she needs a smoke break. So he punches her. And I think that I read it and I kind of was detached from it. I thought, oh, and there's a stunt. And then I do all of this fun stuff and I go up for a cigarette and stunt. And I didn't think about how I would have to process it until we did it. And I was like, oh, this is a thing. Like, I'm getting hit right now. Like, which I think was kind of good. You know, I trust my own instrument. I think it kind of helps me. So that was fair. You know, that happened. But then, you know, the journey after that was just so beautiful to get that opportunity to play that and to, you know, think about her in a deeper way. Like, it's a person whose mother died when she was in high school. That's what they told me. And then she's worked there since she was in high school. And so you have to think, if you're working with trauma every day, it's a convenient foil to not feel your feelings. And so I think that punch just brought a lot crashing down from Dana. And I think she's going through an existential crisis in like 11 and 12. And then, you know, then there's trauma and then it, one more time. So one more time she's taken out of her own feelings and sets it aside to keep working and keep, you know, to saving lives. But it was beautiful to get to consider all of that, you know.
What did that do for you as Catherine, like, in terms of, did it make you think about your dad and what he brought home as a doctor, as a surgeon? Or like, because it's interesting, like, when you reach a certain age and you look back at your parents, things sort of click into place, or you understand things differently of maybe why they were detached at a certain point or angry. Did you think about that in relation to your dad?
I think about my dad in Vietnam. My dad was a flight surgeon in Vietnam. And so I think I asked him once, what was the worst thing you ever saw? And he, you have to think, he's there when he's like 24 years old. And he said that he had to tag and bag a gymnasium full of dead boys his own age. You know, so that's a lot. So I think he rubs really high. And I'm not sure if that's not from the war, you know?
How about it in the final episode, it's sort of unclear if Dana's, like, saying goodbye. It feels like a goodbye, but it also doesn't feel like a goodbye. We know you're in season two, but there is, with the format of the show, I imagine the sort of uncertainty of, like, well, if it covers a shift and I want to not come back, like, what happens? Am I coming back? Am I not? She hasn't wanted to go home, because if she goes home, she has to confront everything.
Yes, exactly.
How were you thinking about what her journey was going to be, and how soon did sort of John and Scott fill in things for you about where she's headed?
I really relax into the writing a lot and just trust it, because they're, Scott Gemmell is really such a great architect. I don't, you know, I thought it was so beautiful. Everyone's stories paid off and everything. So I felt that I could trust that. They told me when we got picked up that I was that I was part of it. So I knew pretty soon. But I think it was kind of, I feel like I'm still sort of, even though we're in shooting right now, kind of just now coming into focus, kind of like where she is, you know. I'm sorry, did I answer the question?
You did, but tell me more. What can you tease about where she's at in her head?
I think that she's changed. I think she's going to start off, it's funny because it's not a broad stroke. That's what, you know, they write in such subtlety. So sometimes, sometimes not. But I think there's definitely less porousness in Dana and less willing to give her whole self over, you know, to situations the way that she did, to always put herself last. I think she's kind of trying to find some healthy balance. I filled in for myself that, you know, that she wasn't doing well at all, and that one of her daughters confronted her and said, you know, this is not working, this, you know, white knuckling of this situation. I think you need to get help. And that I have gone and gotten some grief counseling for myself, going all the way back to dealing with my mother mm-hmm. and helping me deal with the situation that happened. And I think I view her as someone that's now doing more self-care and taking care of herself, like that she's got her meeting and she's got her stuff and she's got her, maybe she even has her like impact classes, like her self-defense classes. She's got some stuff to, you know, fortify herself so that she could come back. You know, a lot of people that go through different types of trauma need to counterbalance that in a way that they feel like they can protect themselves should that mm-hmm. incident come into their life again, so that they feel safe enough to go back into the world. So I sort of imagine something like that for her.
What do you think her husband thought when he saw the black eye?
Yeah, I think he was probably pretty ticked, you know. But I think, you know, as they wrote it, you know, I probably stayed out for a while. So mm-hmm. I think he got what he wanted.
I know there's the boot camp that happens. Mm-hmm. What can you share with me about the boot camp? Who's the star student of the boot camp?
Oh, I think that Mel is the star student. I think that Taylor Dearden would be the star student of the boot camp. I bet you she's the star student wherever she goes.
And where do you fall?
Oh, I'm still the class clown, as I've been my whole life, yeah. I remember one time they had this video.
Oh, my God, what?
Just like this woman had an earring in her throat because she had scooped up a handful of pills and scooped up the earrings with a handful of pills. I'm like, I'm sorry, Mary. Like, do you just have a pile of pills? Like, all over the table? Just like, oh, let me grab some of these. Like, what happens when you accidentally get an earring in your handful of pills?
Wait, but was this an actual person? Or
it was an actual person in a video, and we had to watch them, like, you know, like going with an instrument and get it out of the throat. It was just part of the training. There's a lot of videos.
Uh-huh.
Oh, there's a lot of videos. I look at a lot of them about, like, you know, like this.
But you're not working on actual patients. Oh. You're, like, on the dummies and stuff.
No, there's a lot of videos of real stuff that we see. Yeah, a lot of videos.
How do you do in emergency situations? Are you calm?
Let's see. Yeah, I'm definitely calm. Definitely calm. I get stuff done. I pretty much get stuff done all the time. But, like, I can remember when my son, I had heard him fall, and then my ex-husband, like, went up the stairs, and then he went up, and it was such a crash, and I was like, this is it his face? Is it his face? And I was kind of freaked out when it was my own kid, and, like, I wasn't sure if he had, like, cut up his whole face or whatever, and he did have an arm where he broke both bones, and the arm was like a twisted snake, that was kind of hard.
But see, I'm delusional enough to think that because I've watched, like, every season of ER, every season of Grey's, every episode of The Pitt so far, I feel like I can do what needs to be done, but I'm not. I can't.
You can't.
Don't have anything happen right now. Mm-hmm. I won't be able to save you, but in my head, I think I can.
I really can't handle it. I hate dead animals, dead birds. Yeah. They're very upsetting to me. But I'm very, I'm super face forward into death.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah, okay. I've been with a few people when they died, and I can handle.
You can handle that.
Yeah, I can handle a very scary looking dying person and what they're going through, you know. Yeah, people hallucinate a lot when they're like super sick and they look like a skeleton. Yeah. It's not for pussies. Not, and if for some reason I'm like, I got this. I'm like, y'all can go home. I got it. I don't know. Wow. So I'm very face forward into that, you know. I can handle that. I don't know what it is about it. I was just talking about it today, you know. I feel I'm really happy that I'm able to do it. It's like I don't feel afraid of it. Let's put it that way. And I know that it's scary for most people, and I don't feel afraid. So I feel like I can just show up and be present with people when they're dying and be in it with them for some reason. I didn't know I could do it until my ex-husband was dying. Mm-hmm. And then I was like, okay, I can do this. And then I could do it when my grandmother was dying. And I was like, okay, I can do this.
That's powerful.
It's intense. It's not... earned.
No.
I feel like it just came down from something.
Yeah.
You know, I don't, in other words, I don't think I'm a virtuous person of it. I just think it's some part of my psychology. I can be present in that.
Before we wrap, Dr. Robbie listens to a song coming in and listens to a song going out. Same mm-hmm. song, but it helps him process what he's about to experience. Tell me what you think that song is for Dana.
Rima, calm down. I love that song.
Mm-hmm.
I love that song. It's also a little bit sad.
Yeah.
Something about it has a lot of longing in it.
Hmm.
I love that song. I love that song. I listened to that song when I was going through some of that stuff with Dana. Yeah.
Oh, wow.
Mm-hmm.
So are we, as we leave you, you're taking a break from production, but what gory thing is coming up?
What gory thing? I'm going to have some stuff that I just talked about coming up, I think. I think I'm going to have to deal with some death.
Okay. Okay. Yeah. Well, we're sorry.
I know. Well, they picked the right actress.
They picked the right actress. Well, thank you so much. Is there anyone you're excited to see on Emmys night?
Oh, my gosh. I am just a fan of so many people. I'm a big fan of Jessica Williams. I'm a big fan of Julianne Nicholson. I mean, I'm just a fan of everybody. I'm a huge fan of Jean Smart.
Uh-huh.
Oh, my gosh, so many people. Sharon Horgan.
Yeah.
Yes. Just, yeah, so many fans.
It's going to be a great
night. Yeah, so many people I'm fans of. Oh, my God. I'm a fan of all of our competitors. Sterling K. Brown.
It's good.
Yeah, I know. It's an honor to be nominated because there's some really great work out there. And I kind of hate that both my comedies are, like, up against each other because I love Shrinking. And I love Paul Downs, uh-huh. and that he's just...
Your pickleball competitor.
I know. That's a deep bench over there. I feel like Shrinking and Hack should not be on at the same time. I don't like them competing. Yeah, those are I love those shows.
Yeah. Well, congratulations. We'll be rooting for you. Thanks so much for taking the time.
Thank you.
Thank you.
All right, that's going to do it for the Emmy season. We're excited to see you later on this fall when we start to gear up for the Oscar race. For Mark, for Yvonne, I'm Kelvin, and this is The Envelope.